Chariot Solutions ETE podcast number 3, the Thursday evening live podcast recording. When we were booking guests for the Emerging Tech Show, I had my eye on getting a live podcast going. It just so happened that we booked Michael Cote from RedMonk and James Ward from Adobe, two prolific blogger and podcaster types. I approached them both about doing the show, and they said they'd love to do it. Armed with beer and happy hour food, we set up a table and started chatting. In addition to James and Michael, we were joined by Adam Coombs from Infogy, a company that tracks social media, and later by Ed Burns from Sun and Oracle, who happens to be a Philadelphia area native. We had a great time chatting, and hopefully you'll enjoy listening as well. The topics range from conference sessions to Philly cheesesteaks, the iPhone license changes, to even what the turbo button did on the old x86 PCs. I hope you enjoy the show. Coming up on the podcast stream, we'll start featuring some of the conference sessions. Although we can't deliver them all, we'll try to pick the ones that best translate into podcast form. And as with all blogs and podcasts, the opinions expressed are our personal views and not those of our employers.
We like beer.
Beer's a good thing.
Beer me.
Beer me.
Beer me. All right. Well, welcome to the, Philly ETE 2010 version of the TechCast. I'm Ken Rimple. I'm joined by James Ward.
Yes. Hello,
hello,
everyone.
James.
Welcome.
Michael Cote.
Hello, everybody.
And Adam Coombs. And we're here to just kind of reflect on the show and get a feel for, you know, how things went. So, James, you're doing a talk on Adobe, right? You're on Flex 4.
Yeah, on Flex and integrating with back-end systems. And I'd like to call it Client Server 2.0. Not green screen 2.0. That's what we're doing with HTML right now is green screen 2.0.
Right.
How do you feel about that, Cote?
Well, green screen in the sense that it's crappy?
Green screen in the sense that it's interpreted on the client. Markup sent to the client, interpreted.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that approach. It worked.
Yeah.
It's old school.
It is. Well, but everything old is new again.
We're going to use all sorts of like comments like that. So, when did you come in?
I got in
Wednesday night.
Yesterday.
Right? Mm-hmm.
What day was that? Wednesday?
That was Wednesday.
I left snowy Denver and arrived in like 90 degree Philly. It was fantastic.
Well, cool. And Michael, you're doing the keynote tomorrow.
That's right.
And you're, RedMonk is your company, your analyst company. Is that?
That's right. We're a industry analyst firm. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of like Gartner or Forrester in that regard.
Like but the open source version of Gartner or Forrester,
that's
I
right.
would say.
Whatever that may mean. But essentially, you go to redmonk.com and all of the research we have is just freely available, which is great for me because then I don't have a review process or anything. I just write something up and publish it, which is thrilling. And I had a talk today about just like a sort of like grab bag of emerging technology stuff from the consumer world to consider using in the enterprise. And then tomorrow...
Really? Was that the name of your talk, was Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise?
You know, I think I came up with some cheesy thing. This is back in the fall when you guys were planning it, right? And I remember that was right after, I think, this whole idea of ramen startups was a popular phrase.
Ramen startups.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, I've kind of realized that... this is probably going to like get people to hate me, but I've kind of realized that Hacker News has kind of like jumped the shark as far as like... sort of like new thinking. It's a very sort of like cargo cultic kind of thing, which makes it fantastic because you can really track developer sentiment. Anyways, they had this idea that, you know, what you want to do is make all your developers eat ramen, and then that's your path to riches. And so I was thinking, you know, that it, you know, I'm always trying to be a little snarky, and I was thinking like that's so basically in the enterprise context, you know, you're not really eating ramen. You've got quarterly numbers to worry about and revenue and stuff like that. So
it's top ramen then.
That's right. Top line ramen.
Just a little bit more.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking, you know, I think the original title, which I can't kind of believe that I actually titled this was from ramen startups to white knuckling the end of the quarter or something like that. And I think the idea was like looking at all these fancy consumer technologies and figuring out how and if they might apply in the enterprise and how things are different and stuff like that. And then, yeah, like you're saying, there's a bit of cloud talking tomorrow morning, which should be exciting. You know, there's nothing like a little cloud at 8:45 in the morning.
And it's partly cloudy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Adam,
yes.
You gave a talk today. You were discussing social media and tracking social media. In terms of getting a word out, we do a lot of stuff in social media.
Yeah.
And especially around podcasts. I've always found, at least from the podcast perspective, it's kind of hard to directly find out what, besides download numbers, are people really listening? How do you measure what you're doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was talking with, back when Dan Farber was the CNET guy before he became the CBS Online overlord. And this is when we were starting to do videos, and kind of video stuff was a little popular. He was like, and he described videos and podcasts as incomprehensible media. And, you know, I mean, being a text guy, what he meant by that is kind of what you're alluding to, that it's sort of like you can't really, like a video or an audio chunk is very indecipherable by all the ways we track this sort of stuff. And so you're kind of, and you know, I do a ton of podcasts, so don't take this the wrong way, but it seems like a podcast is perhaps the worst social media artifact ever as far as the tracking and all the all the numeric stuff you want to do. And yet it's perhaps one of the more delightful ones to do, just because it's despite all the fancy equipment, it's really easy and fun just to talk with people.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if this is one of the reasons why Adobe purchased Omniture, was to be able to allow people to really start adding some real analytical tracking into their video content. I don't know. I haven't really seen anything about that, but it could be some interesting Flash video plus Omniture tracking. Who knows?
So, Adam, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you guys track podcasts?
Right now, we don't have any sort of technology built in to analyze audio or video. It's all text-based, but, you know, I think that there are some technologies that are starting to come out that we could utilize. YouTube, for example, they started doing analysis on videos and turning them into captioned text. So, you know, we can start picking that up at some point. But, you know, our big focus is just pulling in the influential text content that we know is influential, blogs, tweets, things like that, social network content. All that is, you know, readily available. People are reading it. People are consuming it. And we want to be able to collect all of it that we can and track it and let the companies that we work with analyze that really, really quickly without having to read any of it effectively.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, unless you're capturing it with your own custom player and you're forcing them, which no one wants to do because they want to take their iPods around, you know, or whatever, the iPhone or whatever. It's kind of hard to track the stats. So.
Yeah.
It would be
interesting to be able to correlate, like, tweets to when somebody is actually, like, watching one of your videos and be able to correlate, like, what is their sentiment at this point in this media.
Right. And that's a great, great example of how it could be used. You know, all of our data is exportable, so you could effectively, you know, look at trends, compare it to how many times your video was viewed, things like that. So how much were you talked about, you know, over that time period, and then you can correlate those two and see if there's a rise, for example. So.
Yeah. One other interesting thing that I find people do with my Drunk on Software video podcast is a lot of people watch it in a tab that is not active. I guess they're not really watching at that point. They're listening. And then as soon as they hear something interesting that kind of like triggers something, then they flip over to it. And so I wonder if there's some way to, like, I guess there is through JavaScript or whatever, to detect like when the tab is actually active and know like when they're actually looking. And then you'd be able to pull out like the segments that people were actually really interested in.
Mm-hmm. That's always my biggest fear in like a WebEx or something, with like that someone's tracking if I'm actually like looking at that as the primary thing.
Were you paying attention, Cote? Well, excuse me.
That's the way that I use online videos when they give me those ads. I just open up a new tab, not listen or pay attention to it whatsoever, and then go and watch my video.
Absolutely.
Don't market to me. Please stop.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like the TiVo version of online video.
Right.
Skip the ads.
Yeah, except you can't fast forward.
Yeah.
So, we should figure that out.
Yeah. So has anybody gone to other sessions, things they've liked at the show so far? What have you seen that you liked?
I went to the rewards and pitfalls of cloud stuff for the enterprise at 4:00. I thought that was pretty fantastic because it was like it was a good, with even without the audio, you had a slide deck that was basically a bunch of little like one-liners about how cloud stuff works and doesn't work, and you know, it's always nice to hear people talking about actual things they're doing and the way stuff changes, and I forget the names of the two people presenting, but the summary was, it's basically like, you know, it's better in some ways, but it's also just, it's qualitatively just different crap you have to put up with, which was kind of exciting to see and to hear those war stories. And then there's one other that I went to.
I went to Jeff Barr's.
That's right. Yeah. You know, I was being the lazy analyst, and I was like, oh, this guy's going to tell me all the features that's in Amazon, so I don't have to go learn about it myself, which it was great in that respect. I got fully updated. It's fantastic. He's very succinct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about you?
I was at Jeff Barr's with Cote, and it was enlightening. I've already made the switch to EC2 and RDS, which it was great to hear about some of the other things that they provide.
Mm-hmm. As anyone see, did you see the keynote, Uncle Bob Martin's keynote?
I heard it was fantastic. I was prepping for my session, but
yeah. It was funny. They actually did. He opened it up by opening up a window. He said, "This is a short movie," and in the movie, he fires up, I guess, TextMate, and he starts scrolling Java code, and he's playing Ligeti, like in the beginning of 2001, A Space Odyssey. And for the entire, like, 6 minutes of the piece, he's scrolling the same, you know, file of Java code.
Unreal.
And he had everyone on the floor.
Yeah.
You know,
I used to have to deal with a piece of code like that.
I think we all have, you know?
A piece of code. That's when you know something's wrong.
Yep.
It's not code. It's another word, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, it was also singular. Great because it was like this... This is like in the Badlands of Java where we were like, we must have interfaces and then actual implementations. And then you spend all your time in this weird file that ends with impl. And because it's like database relational mapping that has performance stuff built into it, after a few years, it starts becoming like the piece of code that everything happens in.
Right.
Which is always thrilling to deal with. And I'm not sure people really know how to cope with maintaining code that's maybe, you know, a quarter as old as they are, essentially. It starts to become like that.
That was a lot of what he said. One of his main pieces was that, you know, a lot of coders are kind of like the 11-year-old kid who leaves his laundry on the floor and, you know, doesn't really clean up after themselves because they don't feel like they need to. And, you know, it's someone else's problem, right? And you run into a lot of developers, it's someone else's problem. It's not my problem, you know?
Yeah,
I'm one of those, I'll admit, right now.
We don't actually do what we propose. Is that the line from Office Space?
You know, I don't even comment my code because it's so beautiful and just comments itself, you know?
Self-commenting code?
Absolutely.
That's
it's the best code ever.
Does it make a smart-ass comment after the comment? Like a snarky remark code.
He doesn't actually do normal comments. He puts smart-ass comments after the self.
Ooh, that's even better.
Documenting code, yeah.
See?
Yeah. Absolutely.
There you go. That works. Yep. So, anything you guys have done in Philly? Have you gone out to restaurants or anything like that?
We did. Last night we went to some famous Japanese place.
Yeah, I think it was called Morimoto or something.
Ooh.
And it was
delicious. We were there for about 3.5 hours.
Like a big, long, drawn-out dinner?
Yeah. Several people at the table got the tasting menu, which, you know, is like a...
That was the 3.5 hours, and Cote and I didn't get the tasting menu, so we sat there watching everyone eat all of their courses, except for like when they got to the entree course, like halfway through, and that's when we got to eat our entrees, and then they continued eating like four more courses after that, and we sat there and watched them for another hour.
Did you get a silver dollar-sized portion, too, for your entree? Or?
Oh, no. We
plenty of food?
Cote didn't.
My general rule of thumb when you go to a Japanese restaurant, well, one, as... You know, the closer you are to an ocean, you should probably eat sushi, right? And we're more or less close to the Atlantic here, which I don't know if that's a good source of sushi or not, but whatever. It's an easy metric. And then also, like, you just want to order, like, the chef's special or whatever, right? Like, there's so many sushi choices, and you're going to, like, waste all this time thinking about this, and who doesn't like quail eggs, and who doesn't like this, and who likes that? And so you just order, like, the chef's selection. And then you just get this big plate. And it's great. It's like, you know, they come out and they tell you all the sushi as if I'm, like, listening. I have no idea what they're saying. But you get a nice portion of sushi. It's delicious. And it's like a little adventure.
It was an adventure.
Yeah, and we had some, like, cloudy sake and stuff. And, you know, the highlight interior design-wise for me is if you went down to the bathrooms, one, they didn't have doors on them. They just had nice, discreet hallways. But the hand dryers, they actually had embedded in the wall, and then they had these, like, wavy cutouts. And there was a sign that just said dry. And so, like, you would just, like, stick your hand. And I tried to stick my hands in there, and they didn't work. So it was kind of a disappointment.
We should have got a picture of that, because that was... I don't know what usability folks would think about that. I think they'd be disappointed.
Yeah, it's sort of design over function. I think.
Put wet hands here.
That would have been more descriptive. That would have worked.
How about yourselves? I mean, we are in Philadelphia, so you're supposed to get, like, the cheesesteak, right?
Yeah. I've eaten nothing but cheesesteaks.
Oh, so what do you recommend? Where does one go?
You know what? I haven't tried enough of them to give you a solid recommendation. Yeah. I haven't even tried Pat's or Gino's yet. So.
Oh, yeah. I learned in Twitter that those are the two that try to go to.
Those are the classics, but... But see, the locals, I hear that they, you know, they're all over the place. I hear recommendations, you know, for lots of different ones. So I tried Campos last night. It was pretty fantastic. But
do you do it with a Cheese Whiz?
I have not had one with the Cheese Whiz.
You haven't
yet.
Had the Cheese Whiz?
I'm going to do it tomorrow. I'm going to have to.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah.
It's a weird requirement. Yeah.
So how many cheesesteaks have you had?
Well, every meal so far, so I guess that's three.
including breakfast?
Yeah, well, they had them. Well, no, I guess I didn't eat breakfast, but they had them here, and I was not prepared to eat a Philly for lunch, but I had no choice.
So have you sort of, like, discovered some new aspect of the cheesesteak that was previously unknown?
No. Not yet, actually. I'm waiting to see. Well, the Campos had a lot of interesting selections, so I had a buffalo-style cheesesteak, which was a little bit random. Had hot sauce in it. It's actually quite tasty.
It is all about
the classic cheesesteak. I haven't had a good classic.
That's a Geno's. Yep. Yeah, you're down here. You might as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I've heard it's all about the bread.
Yes,
really?
It is. Yeah. It's about the roll. Yeah. Totally about the roll.
That's like the primary designator of a good Philly cheesesteak.
Got a nice, like, you know, crust. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the way to go.
Mm. You can tell it's dinner time.
Yes.
You learn something new every podcast, am I right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So let's see. You had no effects from it, but the digestive tract works how long?
Oh, it's been terrible. I'll be honest about it.
You know, you come to a foreign land like Philadelphia, you got to know what you're signing up for, right?
That's true.
Yep, that's true. Good point.
Yeah, I live here, and I don't really go get cheesesteaks, because if I did, I'd be, you know, Orson Welles sized, and that'd be it. You know, but you guys, you're down barbecue land, right, Michael?
That's right. I'm down in Austin, Texas. So.
Oh, I'm in Kansas City. We're going to have a battle.
Oh, there you go.
I will fight you on barbecue.
Hey, as long as I can eat it, it's no problem.
Let me know, fight, baby.
You know, when it comes to well-cooked meat, it's love all around. Who cares? I got nothing to prove. Whether you got your wacky pulled pork from North Carolina, or your St. Louis stuff, or your weird hill country stuff, or... Even like strange stuff that's like wherever. You know, it's all just very tasty.
Nothing like Kansas City barbecue, my friend.
I'm sure it's splendid.
Oh, it is. It is.
So, we got the food thing covered.
Yes.
And you know what I've been curious about, and maybe you guys know better than I do, but like what exactly do people do here in Philadelphia?
That is a good question.
I mean, it's like one of those old American towns where I know there's obviously a lot of people at high paying jobs doing a lot of stuff. But I mean, is it like lawyers, bankers, technologists?
There's a lot of tech here.
I can't figure it out either.
Is it sort of like logistics, shipping? Do they manufacture anything?
I kind of get the impression that everyone's just kind of walking around not knowing what they're doing.
Or is it like everyone just teaches kickboxing? Is that like what's happening?
Oh, you
like...
found us out, actually, yeah. Actually, we're in the Octagon. That's our whole thing. The Philly Octagon movement. You haven't heard anything about that, have you?
No. That's some sort of Illuminati stuff
out.
I don't know
it
about.
It is, yeah. Actually, Cthulhu. Mm. But otherwise safe.
There you go.
Otherwise safe, yeah.
We're going to get the squid folks from the shore coming up. That's great.
Right. But, I mean, most of the IT, there's a lot of financial here.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff in the financial sector, and there's healthcare. So there's been a lot of IT for a long time.
So to switch topics a little bit, there was a big iPhone 4.0 announcement today.
Oh, I was all over that.
Yeah. I pretty much missed a whole session because I was watching that.
Oh, it was good. It was good.
But I think the really interesting thing that just happened, and just in the last couple hours, actually, was that they discovered that the terms of service for the new iPhone SDK no longer allow you to build apps in anything other than Objective-C, C, or C++, which kind of screws a lot of people, like PhoneGap and... Adobe's iPhone Packager.
They had JavaScript in there, right?
And JavaScript,
It's kind of interesting that you would have a... there's nothing wrong with JavaScript, but that's an interesting corporate choice, right? Obviously, you're going to choose Objective-C because there's the only person who cares about Objective-C is Apple, right? So that's what they got going for them. But JavaScript is... That's curious. I don't think it's bad, but it's interesting that they... like this idea that you would develop a whole application in JavaScript is kind of fascinating.
Well, that's kind of the Palm model, right? Like WebOS?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Well, I guess with some of those, it's HTML, JavaScript on the front end, and they go to a controller in Ruby. That's what the Row Mobile does.
But that wouldn't be allowed.
Apparently not. Yeah. Yeah. That's
so,
really interesting.
Yeah, so the Row Mobile and the PhoneGap, and a lot of people have really kind of gotten irate about this whole thing.
Yeah, I think the phrase would be freaked out.
Freaked out is probably a better way to put it.
and then it was also like y'all's Adobe's Packager stuff wouldn't work either, because it also excludes it's interesting, the word, it's very, very clear. It's sort of like the original code has to be this.
Right.
And yep. So, I don't know, maybe there's some sort of how many original codes are on the head of a needle sort of debate you right. could do about what is original code. Like, is that the binary state? Like, what, who knows? But,
yeah,
but yeah, that is kind of a weird sort of thing to do there. But, yeah, you know, it made me think, like, I'm curious, like, what all these people did to piss Apple off so much, or if they're just... They're just unruly.
Well, you kind of look at Apple's history and...
Yeah, yeah.
I think Steve Jobs, like, he just goes for something like the whole no flash on the iPhone thing, right? Huh? As you were showing with, like, some of the research you were doing, you can certainly run it on Android, right? Yeah.
Well, and I wonder how this decision, if it really is what we think it is,
right?
How that's going to impact Android.
Yeah.
Because if it really pisses off a lot of developers, you got to wonder, where are they going to go? Right. And Android seems to be the obvious choice.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's like the weird thing you're competing against is people making money and people hoping to make money, right? And so,
right.
I mean, as long as there's cash floating around in the system, then you can be pretty draconian about things.
Right, right.
So if
you gotta wonder how long that lasts.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's the big variable, right? That's what's going. I mean, there used to be a time when no one developed an Objective-C for the Mac, and then the Mac became popular and. Now there's a little thriving marketplace of being able to buy Mac stuff and so forth and so on. Oh. So, yeah, who knows how long it'll last.
Yeah. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Yeah, I think the thing we were talking about in the mobile panel was with Android realizing there's, you know, basically so many different versions of the OS, and they've got to kind of consolidate, get the App Store completely shorn up.
Yeah.
Once they get that and they have a little better distribution model, I think that's what they really need to try to compete with Apple.
No, and you know, I'm not us at Redmonk, or we at Redmonk, I right. should say. We're not what you would call quantitative analysis. So we don't really do numbers or study things. We just kind of, like, make sure we eat a lot so we have a prodigious gut we can think in and speak from. And
you're from a key.
That's
yes.
right. That's right. Intuition, yes. I think they call it. We're qualitative analysis. But, you know, so anecdotally, like, talking with people, when they try to go out and get an Android phone, right? It's like a much different experience than when you go out to buy an iPhone. So, I mean, it's an interesting, from a technologist standpoint, you're taught that proliferation is a good idea and you shouldn't have mono-platform. And basically, you shouldn't be, you know, Windows and Microsoft, right? But
right.
it seems like a lot of the success that you see in the iPhone is it's very difficult to screw up buying an iPhone. What I mean to say is, so let's say you went to a random wireless outlet, right? And you were like, I want an iPhone, right? Like, you would end up buying an iPhone. Whereas if you went to a random wireless outlet and you were like, I want an Android phone, like, you're not. It's not so much of a guarantee that you would get an Android phone. And as an example, like, there's this great podcast. This guy Robert Brook, you look it up. It's fun stuff. And he was saying how he went into I don't know what it was. He's in the UK, so they have crazy brands. I don't know about, like, Car Warehouse or something. And he went in and he was like, hey, so do you have any Android phones? And the staff person there was like, nope. And he's like, so these three phones over here that say they're Android phones, are those Android phones? And he's like, oh, yeah, those are Android phones. And so it's, you know, I mean, that's kind of the point, is that it is, yeah, I mean, you have to be educated. You have to be a savvy consumer to get an Android phone, whereas you can just be anyone to get an iPhone, which yep. is tedious.
Yeah, and it's not as polished, and you have all those issues as well. So it definitely appeals to the geeks more, for
right.
sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
But did you see the numbers on Android sales for, what was it, they just released them for first quarter of 2010?
Yeah, they
No. Now, James, you know we don't do numbers.
So oh, that's right. Sorry.
I have no idea.
Quality. I remember that part now.
Yes. It from the increased. Is that good?
Yeah, the percent increase of Android sales, or I think it was even the cumulative Android sales for first quarter 2010, was like way more than iPhone sales. So.
Yeah, no, and I think that's what everyone sort of hopes for, is just what would you call it, brute forcing it, where it's just sort of like
just by volume of
yeah, you just flood the market
selection.
Yeah, and so no matter what you do, you might end up with one of them. And I mean, if you can manage like you guys were alluding to earlier, the multiple versions and multiple things, then that'd be great. Like, nothing wrong with an open platform.
Well, yeah, and the other interesting thing I think they have going for them is that anybody that knows Java can really easily write yeah. applications for Android, whereas for iPhone, you have to learn a whole new language. You have to, I guess now, you have to use Apple's tools and be on a Mac and use Xcode and, you know, those sorts of things, whereas for Android, they have the SDK for Windows, Mac, and Linux. They have Eclipse plugins, so
right.
it's a lot of Java developers out there that can start building apps. There's Ed. Should we have Ed on?
Yes, we should have Ed. So this is Ed Burns is coming on here. We're going to bring him up from Oracle.
We like to say that. He's now from Oracle.
Sun Oracle?
Yes, Oracle. Oracle America, Inc.
Oracle America,
Funny Inc. little story. We got on the Oracle homepage. Every Oracle employee now in the U.S. has to file another I-9. Because when they incorporate, they change the name.
Right.
So it was Oracle USA, and now with the acquisition of Sun, it's Oracle America.
Wow.
So that's what it says on my slides.
So now you work for Oracle America.
Oracle America.
So Ed, you delivered the secrets of a programming
rockstar. Rockstar programmer.
Uh-huh. So
it's a talk that is trying to get to the root of some of the questions that programmers tend to ask themselves when they have enough time to lift their heads up off of the keyboards. Such as, oh my God, I mean, how do I stay current on all the stuff that's coming down the pike here? How do I keep my family intact when I'm having to work these 80-hour weeks?
Does that include, how to keep your wife happy? And
somewhat, yeah. It was interviews, and it was talking to other programmers about how they do these things.
You need that time benefit spreadsheet that you can you can show.
Yeah, right.
ROI is really useful for a spouse.
Rational discussion doesn't come in this, no. generally. But, yeah, that's the topic, so talking about these kinds of themes.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you go out with these guys last night to the restaurant? Where'd you guys go?
Well, no, I went to the Cloud Stars, and then, you know, I'm such a Phillies fan that I just stayed in the bar
and watched the rest of the game. And they won.
They did win. Hamels did okay. Yeah.
Apparently, Ed Burns grew up right across the street from where I live.
That's right.
Right, in Delaware County.
Very small world.
Yep.
Literally. Across the media line.
Which was easy to get him to come here, because he's like, oh, can I come here? Because my people live here, and right. I'm like, no problem.
Well, I had the pleasure, for the first time ever, of bringing my son to see me speak today.
Oh, very cool.
And I work from home, right? So there's really no take your son to work day.
Here it is, kid.
Yeah. Oh, great.
This is my
every
desk.
Day is. I've always wondered what was in this room.
So this is the closest I can come.
Right.
Bring him to a conference. But that was great. And it was made possible by being here in Philly.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about mobile development of iPhone and Android and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the whole... Well, just switch gears, I guess. With the whole Sun, Java, Oracle thing,
mm-hmm.
what are you focusing on? You're doing still the JSF work?
Yes, I am.
ADF.
Well, ADF is one of the libraries that built on JSF. And, uh-huh. you know, JSF, I was talking to someone last night, and this will come up with the framework battle.
The framework battle,
I prefer to call it a smackdown, but a battle.
I'm starting to get concerned.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
He called JSF an example of a hostile abstraction layer.
And, Scott Davis.
You can call it. It is certainly an abstraction layer. There's no question about that. And there are many abstraction layers. And the more I think about this, the more it's like, you know, we're all just trying to do good things for our users. And some of our users are stuck in environments where they have these corporate things and they have to follow standards and stuff. And so I'm going to do the best I can to make life easy for those people.
Right.
And so that's what I've been trying to do with JSF.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So would you say that a secret of a rock star programmer or developer or whatever, is it better to be nice or to be snarky?
I would definitely say niceness is the attribute. I mean, on my slides, I had a couple of the attributes, and the first one was not a jerk, right?
Yeah, yes.
So, yeah. You have a great radio voice, by the way.
Oh, well, you know.
Anyone else notice that?
He really does.
Yeah.
It is nice. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. I've been thinking it.
Yeah, you know, the interstate's all clogged up now. You might want to avoid that.
We don't have a 405 here, but you can use some other route. 96-95. Oh, God. So wait, so you said you were snarky, so is that why you're an analyst now? Is that how that works?
Well, I've just noticed that there is... well, I guess the short answer is yes.
Yes.
But... snarkiness is a certain sort of rhetorical tool that you use to sort of uncover... things that are more interesting than staring at the wall, I guess. And it's also just, I don't know, somehow, I think my dad was a smartass, as he would say. I don't know if I should have put some asterisks in there, but it's just, I don't know, it's who I am, so I guess I kind of embrace it a little bit. But it's also nice that if you're going to be snarky, I guess, it's good to be a little self-aware and be able to argue against yourself and
exactly.
also be kind of unbiased, because otherwise you end up being a jerk.
Right, so the snarkiness and niceness are not mutually exclusive at
exactly,
all.
Right.
They can be complementary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes your jerkiness can lead to being a rock star, like Connie, right?
Yes, but he's actually quite charming
he
in
is,
person.
He is in person. His, yes. The bio blog does not reveal that aspect at all. But
and what I loved about this, I mean, here I am the JSF guy, and he goes to great lengths to impugn JSF.
Absolutely.
And you know, he fell off the bio blog. It's just not as... It doesn't, you know, it doesn't do it
anymore.
He
became a nice guy. Well, no, I think it was when he joined the JCP. He became...
Ah, you got to see the other side.
That's right. He saw the other side.
No wonder all of this is so crazy.
Yeah. He had to get all political on us.
Well, to be fair about JSF, I mean, it's gone through some major changes from 1.x to 2.x, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you've simplified configuration, right?
Right. Well, my main thing with JSF is... And I'll continue to state this. A standards body is not the place to do innovation. A standards body is the place to standardize. So the time we spent between 1.2 and 2.0, myself and other people in the JSF community were out there either inventing stuff or listening to other people who have invented stuff. You know, the quote, Richard P. Gabriel has the innovation happens elsewhere quote, but someone else came up with innovation happens everywhere, and that's more appropriate. But, yeah, we try to take all these things from the best ideas and then integrate them as cleanly as possible into the Java EE platform.
Now, I think that's interesting. So if you look at, like, JPA, it's obviously a lot of that came from Hibernate, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for JSF 2.0, is there someplace like that that a lot of the innovation came from?
Well, it's more of a grab bag. Yeah, there are certain things, but it's not like one predominant thing where we took Seam and made it JSF 2.
Right.
It wasn't that at all.
Yeah.
There are a couple things from Seam that we grabbed.
Yeah.
A couple things from Rails that we grabbed, a couple things from the various Ajax solutions that we grabbed, and a couple things from Objective-C that we grabbed.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of scary.
Well, it's very lightweight, but we do have this composite component concept where you can author a JSF component using only one markup file, and in that markup file you have a tag called interface and another tag called implementation.
Right.
So it's more like a tip of the hat than anything else. But,
right.
But the concept is there.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, since you've got your Rockstar developer thing going there, what was the, I'm curious, like, when you were talking to these people, what was the one thing that you sort of, like, disproved that you'd thought? Like, did you go into it thinking, like, this would be an attribute, and you were kind of, like, shocked?
That's a good question.
It was not really the case.
Or
were you like, oh, I was right all the time?
No, I think it was I expected everyone to be an organizational maven. Like, had already thought of getting things done in their head before it had been written.
Mm.
You know, but not all of them were.
Right.
It wasn't enough to say this was a defining attribute.
Right.
It certainly can't hurt to be that way.
Right.
But it's not a precondition, precondition.
Huh, that's interesting.
Was there some...
It's hope for the disorganized people in the world.
Right. Was there a common theme that you kept running into over and over again?
Oh, well, there was a lot of that.
I'm sure a number of them, but...
Yeah, I mean, mastery of tools was one of the ones that I really ran into a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Humility and awareness of your ignorance, you know, like the things I said in the talk, not being ashamed of, adamantly not being a know-it-all. Like, maybe they had a point in their life where they were a know-it-all a while ago, but they'd long since passed that on their road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like you get to a certain point in your career and realize you're not the best of everything.
Right.
Period.
Get
over yourself and move on.
The Hani chapter has some really good content on that, actually. He has some really good things. Like, his quote is, when I'm trying to debug a problem, the first thing I will say is, well, I'm the problem. And start there and move out.
It's a good place to start from.
And then he would say, oh, man, I can't believe how many times you see a post in the forum. Oh, it's a bug in the JVM. Or it's how many is that? How often does that happen? You know, certainly not as often as people would post reports. This is what Hani would say. But, yeah. Well, I want to hear about the let's talk a little bit about the divergence of client devices. Like, you know, a couple years ago, I used to wonder to myself, what's going to be the winner? Is it going to be thin, rich, you know, rich, thin? There's all these different categories, right? And now what I came to the conclusion of then was there's not going to be one winner. It's going to be all of the above. And so that's my theory. It's going to be all of the above. What do you guys think of that?
Like what the client platform. Like if you were developing some software that you wanted to base your living off of, what UI layer and platform would you choose?
Yes.
Hmm.
And you know, now we see with the way Twitter has evolved, it is the UI layer is, you know, in all these different places. There's an SMS version. There's a rich client version. There's an
saying.
iPhone version.
There's many different avenues that your users interact with the software that you're creating.
Because we were, you know, when doing JSF, we were thinking, oh, is it going to be Flex or is it going to be Silverlight or kind of nonsense. And we'll probably talk about that some tomorrow. But I really think the answer is going to be all the above
for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the life of a developer in that respect is pretty annoying nowadays.
It's just too many choices.
Like, it's just like the T-shirt you guys have for this conference, right? Where it's like, we got all these different frameworks and UI layers and everything. And I mean, I think the truth of the matter is you have this explosion of them. And if you were to choose only one of them, you'd be shooting yourself in the framework or the foot or whatever. So, I mean, really, you have to, like James and I were talking about this last night. You know, I mean, I come from a generation of developers that was taught you learn Java and you're done, right? Like, or you learn .NET and you're done. You learn some language.
It's like the language for your lifetime.
Exactly. Right. And like, the runtime is going to take care of you, right? And that I mean, the runtime nowadays is like an old, dilapidated, like, you know, bayou house. Like, it's not really going to take care of you anymore. And so, you know, one day you might need to whip out some C to write some mod crap in Apache, or you might need to do some crazy Objective-C stuff or whatever. And it makes me glad I'm not a developer anymore, because I really had very little tolerance for learning things new.
Well, the Rockstar Programmer view on that, and this is another thing they all had in common, was focus on the fundamentals.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all you really can do. And this is one of the things I got when I talked to Dave Thomas, not the pragmatic Dave Thomas, but the object-oriented Dave Thomas, and he's kind of like the grand old man of the book, because he's been around forever, and he's seen everything come and go several times already now. And he was like, "Yeah, just read the one they do at MIT."
Is that like the Dragon?
The Lambda papers.
Okay. Right.
The Dragon one's the compiler one.
Right, right.
Structure and interpretation of computer programs.
I'm just pretending like I know what I'm talking about.
Alex Miller just put a post out about that. They're using that at the Lambda Lounge now. They're going through that, and it's funny because at Chariot we have a couple people that are going through that now too. So it seems like people are going back to basics too. You know, closure and Lisp and tail recursion and all these other things that, you know.
And just to cope with all the nonsense.
Right. Yeah. And at least make sense of it, yeah.
I always feel like I'm missing some major part of my programming knowledge because I never did small talk. Right?
Me either.
And everyone's
no, I haven't
like,
either. I'll fess up.
With that, yeah.
I feel like I'm just worthless, you know, in the programming sphere because
there
I
should
never
be
did small talk.
There should be an app for that.
There should be an app for that.
not small talk, but like... fill in the holes in your computer science education app.
Yeah.
There's a gap for that.
There's a gap for that.
That was my only contribution to this conversation.
Very good.
But
I love the contributions just kind of sail in there and leave one comment and just everyone's like, ah.
Yes.
No, I actually, I kind of think, you know, our co-founder actually is a genius developer, and one of the reasons he's so good is he started sort of on a very low level. So, you know, knowing kind of how computers work, not necessarily just picking up a code and learning it that way. So everything sort of spawns off that, you know, it goes all the way down to the assembly, you know, level. But the idea is that you can all build off, you know, what you know about how it works. So it's almost like you kind of have to have an intricate knowledge of the inner workings of how, you know, a computer kind of functions before you can be a really, really good developer.
That's
and
absolutely
be able to
true.
Adapt to any language.
Yeah, there's always been good conversations around what programming language did you learn first.
Yep.
For me, it was first Pascal and then assembly. Mm-hmm. And the two of those combined were, a great way to really learn first, like, the basics of programming, and then second, what's really going on when I actually write code, like what really happens with the CPU and all this sort of thing. So
I don't think you wasted any time at all. You just didn't go down the whole Lispy route, right?
I never got to Lisp. I feel like I need to pick up Clojure so I can learn some Lisp stuff. But
one of the other questions I found was very kind of illuminating was to ask me what was your first computer that you had. Because to the point you said, I feel that those of us in my generation, I'm 37, who grew up in the 80s, really had a big advantage because we grew up along with the industry as it itself evolved. So we didn't have to worry about coming into a system that everything was already figured out. I mean, when we started out, you know, had to write your own disk routines, and you know, but still, it wasn't so old as the people in the previous generation who have an even further, deeper edge, you know?
Wouldn't that be strange to, like, learn programming in the Java or C-sharp days where, like, memory is managed for you, you have a virtual machine, like, all these things just happen for you?
Right, what do you do?
I feel like you're missing out on a lot of aspects of programming.
You have to work a lot harder to get that knowledge. Yeah. And we were just kind of, there was no choice but to get that knowledge. But I want to ask, you know, what was your first computer? Mine was the TI-99/4A.
I had a 286.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so a little bit
Michael,
older.
What about you?
Well, my dad worked for IBM, so we had an XT and then an AT.
Oh, did he work on the team that did those things?
I don't know. He used to work in manufacturing back when we did that here. And he worked on the circuit boards down in Austin.
Cool.
And, yeah, he was deathly afraid that his boss would be over for dinner and would see that he had a Packard Bell or something and fire him. So he spent way too much money on archaic systems with 5 1/4 inch or whatever they were in drives.
Yeah.
But, yeah, those were great machines. They had, like, that gigantic red switch. It's just so,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, I remember that.
Like, that red switch is, like, as fun as using as an iPhone, right? Like, it's so, like, tactile.
Oh, I know. Like, IBM has always had great tactile.
And also, if you got pissed off at the machine, boom, you can just turn it off.
Right.
Which is, like, try to turn off a machine nowadays like that.
I know.
Hold it down, get mad, push harder.
Yeah, exactly. Like a MacBook. Like, you still are, like, at you're a hostage of the machine.
Yeah,
which is, makes you feel like an idiot.
Mine was a Commodore 64.
Yeah, that was a great, great one.
Peek and poke.
Apple II.
Apple II. 2E.
Yeah. I can't remember. I was too young. I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah. 2GS?
Honestly, yeah.
What color was it?
Huge.
Okay. It was probably the 2E.
I like that.
Yeah, it was
great. Yeah. Anyone here read Dr. Fun? Remember Dr. Fun? Internet cartoon from 95 or so. Really great. This guy Farley from University of Chicago. And we had him come down to our student chapter of the ACM. And, you know, he was like the first internet comic. And he had a little panel of, and you could probably Google it, the, you know, executives decide what color the Mac should be. And it's like they're all pulling their hair out and they just say beige. And the way it's drawn is really funny.
It's going to look really good when it gets in the sun long enough to turn really ugly. Yeah. That's good. Well, okay, so you went through the first computer and kind of the low-level stuff.
I have a topic.
What was your favorite? Well, okay.
No, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's all right. What was your favorite computer from that era? I had an Amiga, so I was a huge fan.
You mean like the 80s? Or
the 80s.
Okay.
Before, you had the...
The PC era, the personal computer
version. The 8-bit to 16-bit right? So I had an Amiga, and I loved that thing because... You know, you could do your Pascal and your C and everything, but also you could multitask.
Yeah, I know.
It was like the first, I guess it was preemptive multitasking operating system.
It had a 6502 processor.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very advanced. I mean, there's still some people that, you know, sing high praise of the Amiga. For me, it was the Atari 800. Okay. I really like that one.
I think I had a Packard Bell 286.
All right.
That my grandpa bought for me at the Air Force Post or
cool.
something. And it was one of those things that had a turbo button on it.
Oh, the turbo button.
I don't know about the turbo button. What does that do? Yeah. Double clock it or something?
Well, I think the idea was...
on turbo, and then you'd turn off the turbo if you wanted to, like, cheat on the game.
Exactly. Yes. The idea was, and this would never happen nowadays, right? Because the idea was you've got this old software and these new 286 processors. Or maybe it was a 386 box. I don't know. They're so fast that you're not going to be able to play Load Runner or Sopwith. And so what you need to do is you unlock the turbo button so your machine runs slower so that it can use old software. I mean, that was the thing. You didn't push the turbo button because you wanted to go faster. You pushed it because you wanted to turn it off.
Funny. Yeah.
Unturbo.
That's exactly. Yeah. It was kind of. It should have been called the slowdown button, I guess. But no, that was back... you know, I guess I'm a little younger than the Amiga people, but or at least in my use of computers. And that's back when I got a modem and called up BBSs. And that's like when I made my choice between being a social person and computers. And so,
which did you choose?
Oh, I chose the computers.
Okay.
On Friday nights, I'd configure Windows INI files just for fun. Yeah. Instead of
Z modem and Kermit and all that stuff.
Yeah, instead of figuring out how to, like, talk to people and be friends and get someone to buy me beer. That came later in life.
It did come later, but it did come.
That's right.
I enjoyed my TI-85.
85. Well, the calculator, right?
Yeah, the calculator. Because back then, people didn't really realize that you could, like, program calculators.
Oh, I did that, basic.
Yeah, basic. And so we'd build games. The best thing we ever built was...
A calculator game.
They would allow us to use calculators on our tests in school.
Yes.
But and so we'd put in, like, all the stuff... for our tests, we'd write programs for it. Like for chemistry, it was great. You'd put in the whole periodic table, which you're supposed to memorize, into your calculator. But the funny thing is that they started realizing that you could program your calculators, so they made you clear your calculator before the test.
Yeah, I remember that.
So we wrote a program that simulated clearing the calculator.
Oh, that's genius.
Yep. Evil, evil.
Yeah, actually, I really did quite a bit of TI-85 programming myself. I made a stock market game. I made a blackjack game.
Awesome.
And then you could get the cable that would link two calculators together, yes. And then you could play games against each other. Super fun.
That was great. Cool. I didn't learn enough in school because I just sit there and program on my calculator.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Me too. Yeah.
We had actually at that same time in my high school, we had a TRS-16 system of VT-100s. Mm. This is 1985. So I get in there, and they have these little flip books of like maybe 40 pages stapled together. Fortran, COBOL, Pascal, all these programming languages in C. So I got to college already knowing everything I had to take in college.
That's great.
And the easiest college career. I'm like, oh, here, I'll do this for you. 5 minutes. And boom, assignment finished. So
that's great.
I got to learn VI and all that stuff early on. So
cool. That's very cool.
I was lucky. So...
Yeah, I had one of those HP calculators with like the reverse Polish or whatever.
48SX or something.
Yeah, that's like the stupidest $40 I ever spent.
Oh,
I don't like saying 15, 20 plus?
No,
I do because
I know, I never had the tolerance to sit down and like figure out how to use the tool or whatever.
It's just
because it's like I don't know, it's just weird. But it was kind of like fun, like having it, like mm-hmm. having this like. Way too much computer power for like the stupid geometry I had.
You had nerd cred.
That's right.
Nerd cred. This is what I have. It's beautiful.
That's right.
You kind of wonder like what are the devices that kids in high school are programming these days? Like we could program our calculators and that was fun for us as kids.
I don't know.
And that's
a
bit of a tragedy actually.
Yeah.
I don't
absolutely.
Know if they are.
It's too complicated.
Although, I mean, I asked the Rockstar people about this and Carl Quinn from the Java Posse has a teenage son and he said, oh, well, my kid uses Lua to program some game that he's in. So he said that was one of the things the kids do.
Well, I have a 12-year-old, and all I know is that he's basically taken over my first iPhone for games.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the game culture is insane now with kids. And they're too complicated to program yourself, really.
They are. They've reached that point a long time ago.
Yeah. So I just don't think they're going to get that kind of access to that level that they should.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm. Somebody mentioned to me recently, they said, I think that all programmers got into programming because they wanted to build games.
Oh,
that was
certainly
true for me.
My
absolutely.
First program I typed in was from, what was it, Run Magazine for Commodore 64.
Yeah.
It was the adventure game. And I sat there, typed the damn thing in it. It must have taken me like 5 hours. I'm sitting there in my underwear
like
going, I'm so tired.
Like where you're like, look left.
Yeah, look left. Go. Yeah. And of course it had bugs in it. I know what the hell I was doing. But I got it running and I'm like, ha 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 ha. And of course power went out and I lost the listing. Like, why did I do this, you know? But I remember doing that. It was like the first thing I ever typed into a computer.
Actually, yeah, absolutely. The Atari was the thing that got me into it.
Building games. Yeah. It's interesting because we get into our careers and we start building like enterprise software and it's so opposite of building games.
Yeah. It is.
You know,
it really is.
We all got into this to like build fun stuff.
And what are we doing now? We're taking crap from a database and putting it on the screen, editing it and pushing it back to the database again.
So not fun.
That's not shooting lasers.
No.
That's right.
Yeah, but it sure is fun cashing that check.
That is
it?
True. Yeah, you got that right.
Zing. One thing that I wanted to mention actually is... sort of the future of computers. And something I want to bring up is obviously the iPad. People talk about it being a giant iPhone and whatnot. But I just saw a video the other day that I thought was extremely interesting. It was actually a 3-year-old using an iPad fluently, like well. So it makes you wonder, are kids going to be using just touchscreen devices? And if they are, does that mean that most computers in the future will just be primarily touchscreen?
Or does that mean that everyone is going to be mentally about the level of a 3-year-old in about 5 years?
That is a valid point. I don't know the answer to that.
I want my graham crackers and milk and a good, comedy program. I'm good.
Everyone's happier.
Yeah.
I think it's a good point. It seems like that's the way it's going, but there's, the BlackBerry crowd and all those others still like the tactile keyboard. I mean, are you talking about input devices specifically?
Well, anything, really. I mean, just the ease of use, simplifying everything to the point of just being almost stupid, And I think that that's really where things are going.
I think what's happening is that people are trying to make UIs that are much more much more like the world that we interact with in real life. Yep. And that's why the touch screen interfaces and accelerometers and all that thing, all those types of sensors are important in these new devices. It's that we're trying to simulate the real world in a device. Mm. And that's why three-year-olds can interact with an iPad so well, is that the interaction models are very much like the interaction models in the real world.
It mimics basic motor skills.
Yeah. Right. As opposed to checkbox, radio button, drop down.
Yeah.
And how many years have we been living with that, right?
Yeah. Where do you find a combo box in real life, you know?
You know, I mean, there is this
That's
train.
That's a great point, yeah.
There is this train of thought I have had along those lines more recently where it seems like... You know, there's the people complaining about the iPad being the destruction of computational creativity or whatever.
Oh.
And on the one hand, that's certainly true. And on the other hand, it seems like, you know, I don't know how to drive a stick shift, right? And just because it's so easy to drive an automatic. And if I had to, like, do anything with my car, I'd have no idea how to do it. And I'm not sure that computers are more special than that. Like, I'm not... I kind of get this... And I'm not sure if I've convinced of this train of thought, but... You know, maybe if you didn't spend so much time dealing with your computer in the form factor that we know it, maybe that wouldn't be so terrible.
That's why I switched from Linux to Mac.
Uh-huh.
I got damn tired of recompiling my kernel every other day. And when Mac OS X finally came out and had a Unix core on top of a nice thing that wasn't running the X window system, although I still do run the X server so I can run Emacs.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I switched, and it was great to not have to mess with any of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a television is a fantastic piece of technology, right? Like it's great, but we don't treat a television in that same sacrosanct way, if that's a word, that we do a computer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in fact, it's sort of considered bad if you spend a lot of time with a television, right? And so
I've customized my white balance.
I don't know. Like I said, this is more just like me like speculating to myself, but it does seem like. I mean, maybe if a computer only is interacted with 30 minutes out of a day or whatever, then that's cool. I don't know.
What do we interact with the rest of the day?
I don't know.
I heard that there's things called people. I'm not sure about it.
Tell me about them.
No.
No, don't be silly.
Family?
I have no idea. I mean, you know, like I was thinking, like, for example, and this is one, this is just, you know, that's sort of a splattershot of thinking here, but it's sort of... Like I was thinking, you know, like oftentimes what I'll do is I'll have my iPhone and I'll have my little notebook here, and I can't really take notes on my iPhone effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I can take notes really well if I'm paying attention on my laptop because I've got a keyboard, I'm very fast, I've trained myself.
If you're not distracted by Twitter and email.
Exactly, exactly. and that's excellent segue to the next point. And whereas if I have an iPhone, it's such a limited use device that I don't really get distracted, or I have to use it in a serial fashion. Mm-hmm. So if I actually want to pay attention to something, I have a notebook. I actually take really good notes, and I know what's happening, and I'm more interactive with it.
Good old paper and pen.
That's right.
That's
and
so low tech.
And so it does make me wonder that in the same way that we could spend 6 hours a day watching television, maybe we spend 6 hours a day screwing with our computer, which is equally pleasurable. And like if you don't have to worry about paying the bills, why not? I mean, I'd love to watch TV all day. I don't know. It's just we have this notion that the computer as we know it can't ever change the form factor.
You know what? It was Mac Break Weekly I was listening to last week, and they were talking about the iPad, and they said, you know, when people had cars with carburetors, there were these kids that liked to fix their carburetor and tune it and change the fuel air mixture and everything, but 99% of the public just wanted their car to start, and they all had the same problem with the carburetor. And now we have electronic fuel injection, and we don't look at that anymore. We don't care. I mean, no one really thinks now about tuning a carburetor unless they really are completely old school, right?
Yeah, and we still have plenty of auto engineers who make cars for us, right? So it's not like not having to shift a stick caused the destruction of innovation in the automobile
industry. That's a good point.
This sounds like a hostile abstraction layer to me.
That's right.
It sure is. It sure is. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great work.
Oh, here's the thing.
Thank you.
I wanted to. I know a lot of people that bought the iPad like and had pre-ordered it and everything. And so I'm thinking to myself, like, these people that bought one, they're programmers, right? So I assume you already have a solid state hard drive, right?
Well, no, sadly I don't.
See, to me, that's absolutely the next gadget to get.
It should be
absolutely.
I mean, and I don't have either an iPad or a solid state hard drive. Yeah, I've got to get one of those next.
Right. Yeah, you know, because actually, I've got the MacBook Pro here, and then my work roommate Gordon, he picked up. One with the solid state drive, and he's like, "Yeah, it boots in like 7 seconds." Is that what? Yeah. You know, mine takes like 40 seconds to get everything started up.
And doing a build,
see,
forget it.
Boom. That's where you really need that spousal ROI spreadsheet right there. When you get into SSDs, that's when you got to calculate the cost-benefit analysis.
Oh, but if you're an independent consultant, you just work it out and say, look at my billable hour. Look at how much more I'm going to be able to do.
See, I got it. So here's my rationalization is I got the little TV out thing. I'm going to sit there. I'm going to do a whole presentation to my wife in Keynote. Mm-hmm. About how this iPad will ultimately save her time. And then she's going to kick me in the face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that'll be the end of that whole thing.
Well, because the whole thing, whenever you optimize time, what that means is that you don't go spend more time in the park. You spend more time working.
Right.
It's sort of like, oh, I've saved myself 5 minutes so I can check my email 5 more minutes.
Right.
Like, you know, no one's like, oh, now I can stop work at 6:58 instead of 7.
It's just... And the problem is your thesis about single tasking the iPhone is about to change because now it will multitask, right?
Ugh, they're going to destroy everything.
They are. Like we had this one, I'm going to do one thing at a time. Maybe two things. Maybe three things. I'm out of memory. I have to shut down. That's what's going to happen to us.
That's right.
So it will be like every other computer at that point. Then it'll just be another pain in the ass device we have to use.
Just throw hardware at it. Did you see that the multitasking actually won't work on anything before a 3GS?
Yeah, I heard that. My theory is that they're coming out with a new phone in the summer, so then they're
right.
Oh, is this talking about the 4?
Yeah, the 4.0 firmware.
You just throw hardware at it.
Or not firmware, I guess operating system. Yeah. Ah, so this one's dead then. Oh well.
Yep.
What are you
time to upgrade. Yep. Throw hardware at it.
That's the Apple tax, is what they call it, right?
Yeah. I had a friend who was in the guy who wrote the, or actually did the Weird Al interview for the Rockstar book.
Oh, cool.
And he goes to Comic-Con every year.
Uh-huh.
And he referred to something called the George Lucas tax, where it's like every time you go to Comic-Con, you got to give your props to George Lucas because of, you know, all the, you know, power that he injected into that genre and creating. Even though you hate him, you might not, you know, personally, I'm sure he's a good guy, but... It's so foundational. So
right.
The Apple tax and the George Lucas tax are kind of...
Until 1, 2, and 3, I just didn't... Yep, absolutely. All right, well, gentlemen, I think this is a wrap. Thanks to everyone, Ed Burns, James Ward, Michael Cote, Adam Combs.
You got it.
I got it, Combs, sorry.
You got it.
I did it. And Ken Rimple, and we appreciate it. Check on PhillyEmergingTech.com for content from the show, and... Thanks, guys.
All right.
Thank you.
Again.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening. As you can hear, the topics range far and wide. I'm very happy you could get that panel on the show. For more information about the podcast, visit techcast.chariotsolutions.com. You can comment about the show in several ways. Send a Twitter message using the #TechCast hashtag, add comments to the show notes, or join our Philly ETE community, phillyemergingtech.ning.com, where we have a Chariot TechCast message board. Have an idea or guest you'd like to feature on the show? Contact me at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com. Our podcast themes are Free Theme number 3 and number 4 from podcastthemes.com. Huge thanks to Rich Friedman, who lent us the high-end recording gear and helped me set up for the show. You can find out more about Chariot Solutions, including our consulting and education services, by heading on over to www.chariotsolutions.com. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.